Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Costa Poutsikaris. He is the filmmaker of a wonderful documentary film called Inhabit. And we screened, we meaning Slow Food North Shore, my local chapter, and I Eat Green and the Cinema Arts Center screened his film Inhabit this past spring at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington to a great sold-out audience, and it was just wonderful. And I'm really excited to have him on to talk to us about permaculture, which is what the film's about, and his filmmaking and his adventure in filming the movie. So stay tuned for that. He'll be on in just a little bit. First, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city, as well as my weekly recipe. So first, I want to tell you that the Young Farmers Conference, which has been going on for at least 5 years, I'd say, has grown so much that now, in order to get in and get tickets, they're doing it by lottery because there's just more people that want to attend than they can house. So the lottery is open right now for young farmers to register to try to get in to the Young Farmers Conference. The Young Farmers Conference is taking place December 7th through 9th, but the lottery is only open now for another couple of weeks, and it just opened yesterday. So go on to the Stone Barn Center website for more information. I also have a link on my website at IE Green so that you can register for the Young Farmers Conference. It's a great conference. If you've been farming at least a year but less than 10 years, you qualify as a young farmer. It has nothing to do with age. It's how long you've been farming. And it's a really wonderful coming together of farmers and entrepreneurs and people that have been doing it for a long time and really know the ins and outs. So if you're a young farmer, you want to be there. So apply for the lottery. It's $285 for the 3 days from December 7th through the 9th, and they also have scholarships. Also, locally, Fox Hollow Farms is a local farm to where I live, and every Sunday from 1 to 4, they're having a farmer's market at their place, as well as allowing people to dig their own hostas. They raised plants for nurseries for many years, and they're switching over to just vegetables. So there's lots of hostas on the property that you can dig up at a really reasonable price. So if you're landscaping and you want, look up Fox Hollow Farm. Again, I have links for all of these things I'm talking about on my website. On September 8th, there's a national town hall call, Vote With Your Fork. And this is going to be something that you can call in and participate on. And it's being run by the New York Food Policy, New York City Food Policy at Hunter. And, oh, actually, I take it back. This is with Slow Food USA. Mary Nessel is all over the place. She's also doing something with New York Food Policy Council later in the month. But this one on September 8th is Slow Food USA, along with the executive director, Richard McCarthy, and they're going to be talking about voting with your fork. And Mary Nessel is a very wonderful author. She wrote Food Politics. She's also a professor at NYU in the food policy department. And this should be a wonderful call-in. So that's Thursday, September 8th at 4 o'clock. That's today. Okay, September 10th is a nature walk. And that is taking place in Bayport at the Golden Sparrow. That's this weekend. September 11th, there is a Heritage Wheat Planting Festival, and that's being sponsored by Grow Seed, and it's restoring heritage grains. It's out of town, though. It's up in Massachusetts, but it should be a really wonderful event from 11 to 4 on Sunday, September 11th. Also on Sunday, September 11th is the annual North Fork Foodie Tour, which I've been talking about. That's going to be a great event. It's only $25. It should be great. Again, links to these things are on my website. September 17th is the second annual Massive Vegan Potluck. That's going to be at Astoria Park on the Great Lawn, and that's a free event from 1 to 5. There's going to be a great DJ playing music. It should be fun, and it's only the second annual, but let's make it an annual event. It should be great. Unfortunately, I won't be there. I'm going to a wedding in Vermont, and then I'm off to Italy to the Slow Food huge event called Terra Madre. I'm really, really excited to participate this year as a U.S. delegate, and I will be doing a homestay while I'm there. I stay with a family that I have stayed with before, and we've developed a friendship, and it's just so wonderful to return back to the same place I've been before and start knowing the city of Torino, which is a beautiful, beautiful city. And unfortunately, it's not usually in the tourist circle, the loop, but it should be. It's just a wonderful city, and so I'm really excited to participate. And Terra Madre is a gathering of people from all around the world celebrating food and also talking about the challenges in our food system and how are you going to manage feeding the 9 billion people that are anticipated onto this planet. So it's a wonderful coming together, food from everywhere. And this is also Slow Food USA's membership drive this month, the entire month is. And each week there's going to be a different theme focused, and it's, you know, it's something that is really a wonderful organization. Slow Food, you know, is the organization that when I first found out about it, I literally cried. I just felt like, oh, my God, there's an organization that really cares about all the food issues that I find important, about our health, about sustainability, about the way food is processed, about the way it's grown, about the overuse of antibiotics and hormones in our food, about the inhumane practices of animal production, about the detriment that animal production has on our land and our waterways. The list just goes on and on. And Slow Food, you know, while talking about and bringing up all these problems within our food, they don't lose sight of the joy around the table, of bringing people together to celebrate food, to eat real food, not processed food, to support the traditions of cooking and baking and, you know, and what food does. It just crosses so many barriers. A few weeks ago, I talked and wrote about using food in a political arena where people are using food. It was an article in the New York Times about South Korea really using food and kimchi to bring people to the table and to let people know about their culture. And it's a really, it's a wonderful tool to bring people together and to break down barriers. And everybody has to eat, and that's something that's universal and we all share. And so food is just a wonderful way of doing that. And so Slow Food USA is having their membership drive. And for one day only, actually, on September 15th, there is a link that you can get from my website or the Slow Food USA's website to pay what you want to join. The membership fee is $60, and a family membership is $100. And that's steep for some of the people that I know. And that's okay. You still can join now and pay what you want on September 15th. So any contribution will make you a member. And then there's also a date where at the end of the month where another donor has volunteered to match any donations up to $10,000. So that's also a great day to make a donation and have your donation matched. So check out Slow Food USA's website. It's a really wonderful organization that I support wholeheartedly. And, you know, even in their Slow Meat campaign, which as a person who hasn't eaten meat in over 40 years, it's really hard to even get behind that. And yet I know that everyone's not going to become a vegetarian. Let's be honest. People are attached to eating meat. There's so many people that love it. And for many people, they really feel like they need it. But the Slow Meat campaign is to try to raise awareness about the quality of meat that you buy. Buy less of it and put your money into buying higher quality meat, meat that is raised in a sustainable manner without hormones, without antibiotics, where the animals have access to pasture, where they eat grass instead of being fed GMO grain. There's so many different aspects to that, but you want to know where your meat is coming from if you're going to eat meat and commit to that. And, you know, even with restaurants, you know, you can look up restaurants that are committed to that. You can go to the Snail of Approval link on different slow food websites and find restaurants in that area that are committed to that. You know, and when you go to a restaurant, ask the waiter, you know, do you have any organic meat? That's the only way you know that it's really organic, or they say they know it's from a local farm doing the right thing. Some local places don't want to go through the bureaucracy of or the financial expense of becoming certified organic, but you know that they're doing it in the organic sustainable method, and that's fine too. But ask the questions. Ask the right questions. Is that fish wild? Do you want to know? Is that fish farm-raised, being fed artificially color and chicken and fish pellets made from chicken scraps? Or do you want a fish that is swimming freely in the ocean, eating plankton and seaweed and other fish as they're supposed to be doing before you eat it? So knowing about your food and where it comes from is just essential. On September 30th, Yale is sponsoring a food system symposium, and the theme this year is Feeding a Growing World, Perspectives in 2016, and that's a symposium bringing scholars and practitioners together to address these different complex ecological and socioeconomic issues. When it comes to feeding the world, food production, consumption, climate change, urbanization, all of that. So that should be a wonderful event. It's the fourth annual symposium up at Yale University. So hope to see you there. Lots of great events, so do check out my website for more. I want to share with you my recipe now before I introduce Costa to all of you. This week, I stuffed a zucchini. I think for many of us, you know, who grow vegetables, you know, you're out there harvesting all the time, but inevitably you miss something under a big leaf, and then you discover, oh my God, I have this huge, gigantic zucchini that is so big, and the inside is a lot of seeds. What am I going to do with it? And really, the best thing to do with that, the flesh of the vegetable is still delicious, but you don't want to eat all those seeds, so you cut it lengthways, scoop out the seeds, and you have a perfect vegetable for stuffing. And that's what I did with my 14-inch long zucchini. So, and it fed probably, it could feed 6 to 8 people. It's really large, and I made Middle Eastern vegetables with preserved lemon and rice to stuff it with. I had wanted to use wild rice, but I didn't have any in the house, so you can substitute some wild rice in there. I think the color would look beautiful. So I started with my large 14-inch long zucchini. If you want to make this and you don't have that, you can use 2 smaller ones. This was a green one. You can use a yellow one. You can stuff butternut squash with this or acorn squash. It's really, you can stuff anything with it. You can stuff an eggplant with it. That would be fine, too. 1 large onion, chopped. 2 carrots, diced. 1 stalk celery, chopped. 1 cup pumpkin or butternut squash, diced. 2 preserved lemons diced, 5 cloves garlic minced, 2 cups chopped greens, and that's whatever you pulled out of your garden. I had Swiss chard, kale, and Mizuna greens. 2 cups, and I really packed it down because I had so many, so really pack it down there. 2 cups of broccoli cut into florets, 1 cup of red cherry tomatoes, 1 cup of yellow cherry tomatoes, 1 half cup Kalamata olives cut in half, 2 cups of cooked rice, and I used the organic short grain and red bhutan rice. That's what I had here. But like I said, if I had some wild rice, I would have put that in as well. 1/2 teaspoon cumin, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon of Ras El Hanout. That's a spice mixture from Morocco. And, you know, it's a great mixture. I got it at Whole Foods, so I'm sure any Asian market or Middle Eastern market, or if you have a Whole Foods near you, you'll be able to find it. 1/2 cup of dry roasted pine nuts, 1/3 cup chopped mint, and some olive oil for the stir fry. So with a spoon, I first removed the seeds of the zucchini so that I hollowed out the center. I brushed it with olive oil and sprinkled it with salt, pepper, and that spice mixture, Ras El Hanout. And then I covered it with a cookie sheet with parchment paper, and I laid the zucchini out on that. And then I took another piece of parchment paper and covered the zucchini. And I baked it at 375 for about 20 minutes. I didn't cook it all the way through because it was going to cook again with the vegetables in it. While it's cooking, I oiled a large wok, and I sautéed the onions and the carrots in olive oil for about 5 minutes until the onions were translucent. And as I say all the time, when you're doing a stir-fry, you always start with the root vegetables, the hardest ones, so that by the end of the stir-fry, all the vegetables are cooked to the right consistency. So then I added the pumpkin, which is also very hard and takes a long time to cook, along with the celery and the garlic, and cooked that for another 5 minutes. Then I added the broccoli, the preserved lemon, the greens, and the olives. And I cooked that until the greens were soft and reduced in size. Then I added the cumin, the salt, and the Ras Hanout. Added the cherry tomatoes, the mint, the pine nuts, and the rice. And I mixed all that up. Let it cook just a few minutes in the wok to allow all those vegetables to come together. And then I stuffed the zucchini with all those vegetables. And I baked it covered for about 20 more minutes until the zucchini was really soft and the flavor of those vegetables seeped down into the baked zucchini. And it was delicious. I removed it from the oven. I served it on a bed of some of the extra rice that I had. And I garnished it with some mint and some cherry tomatoes. And that was it. It came together really fast, as most of my recipes do. I know people sometimes get a little freaked out by how many ingredients I have in my recipes, but just know that all my recipes are flexible. If you don't have something, you can substitute something else. Even the Ras El Hanout mixture, you can look that up and see what's in it and make your own mixture if you'd like. And that's great. So if you make this recipe, please let me know how you like it. I love getting comments from everybody. Thank you. So now it's my pleasure to introduce Costa Boutsakaris. He is an award-winning filmmaker. He graduated from Mason Gross School of Arts with a BA in Visual Arts. And right at graduation, he decided to start on this adventure to create the film Inhabit. And I'm going to let him tell us more about it, but it's really an adventure that he took discovering permaculture situations across the country, actually mostly in the Northeast area. But it's just a beautiful, beautiful film. We screened it out at the Cinema Arts Center in March, and it was just really loved by everybody that was there. So anyway, Costa, are you with me?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. I wanted to thank you again for the screening in March. I had such a great time in your community, and it was so fun because so many of those people hadn't been exposed to the permaculture ideas and stuff, so it was a really fun conversation. I think it was one of the longest Q&A sessions I've had, so I want to thank you again.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, you know, we have a great community here on Long Island, many people that are already doing farming or homesteading. And, your film really just opened up so many possibilities, I think, for people. It just got everybody's mind working of, like, what one can do if you put your mind to it. It was just amazing seeing all those different examples of people's projects that they took on where they transformed their home from a regular backyard into an oasis. So, So I would love you to tell us a little bit more about, first about your experience. Like, did you always know that you wanted to be a filmmaker? Is that something you came to early on, or how did you come to filmmaking?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of people my age in a similar generation, you know, started like making skateboarding videos and other videos in high school. And then, you know, I think a lot of the inspiration came from realizing that a lot of what I was learning and being exposed to was coming through YouTube and the internet and watching documentaries on the internet, you know, in high school and into college, and realizing that, you know, a lot of ways to connect with a lot of people really quickly you know, it's through good media. And I went to art school and found a concentration in video art and started to play with a lot of different ideas. And really quickly, you know, I realized that there were so many videos that hadn't been made, you know, out on, especially in the world of permaculture and in the world of sustainable design. I kept seeing, you know, major holes in the media that was available on the internet. So I think that's one of the things that started to get me to realize, like, there's really an opportunity still, even though it seems like there's so much out there. There's always this opportunity to fill gaps where there's things missing.
Mm-hmm. And how did you first learn about permaculture?
Yeah, so I think I came to it, I think at the end of college, I basically was getting a little bit wrapped up in this idea of society collapsing. There's this kind of joke in my college, because we were graduating in 2012, and 2012 was supposed to be the end of the world. And so when we graduated college, it was going to be the end of the world. So there was always this kind of like tension about it. And even though no one really believed that, you know, the world coming to an end, there was still a lot of fear about, you know, economic collapse and all these different things. And anyway, when you kind of go down that road, it's very doom and gloom, kind of like, you know, survival and how can you build your off-grid house away from society. But the more I looked into that that kind of mentality, I found this whole other world of permaculture design, which is really thinking about positive solutions for designing systems that are resilient to things like, you know, if the power grid went down, or if the food grid stopped working and stopped transporting food trucks, like, how can we build systems that are actually resilient to that instead of just being scared of them and running away from it all? So I think I got really interested in this whole idea of visioning a new possibility and really thinking about design as the key in all of these things. You know, it's not really about creating a whole new civilization. It's really just about redesigning the systems we already have and kind of modifying them and just bringing in, you know, ecological thinking and holistic design. So I took a permaculture course in New York City my last year of college with Andrew Faust, who is a great teacher and mentor in New York City. And I'll never forget the first day I went in, the kind of the turning point for me was I was really obsessed with sustainability. I was like, well, how do we think about sustainability? And, you know, the first day I went in, one of his opening statements was, you know, we talk a lot about sustainability these days, but, you know, if I asked you how your marriage is and you said it's sustainable, you know, it doesn't sound like a very good thing, you know. So he tried to reframe our thinking about design as, instead of being sustainable, how can we be regenerative, and how can we think about a system that improves, not just maintains status quo, but actually improves the quality of life and improves all these things. So that was kind of a turning point for me in design thinking, and kind of opening up a new, you know, instead of moving away from the fear-based thinking, moving towards this like positive solution design kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it was really remarkable for me too to watch it, because I also am doing a lot of gardening and a lot of farming, but it requires me every year putting the seeds down and, you know, starting all over every spring. Mm-hmm. And the idea of planting more things that come back on their own every year is something that I have some fruit trees and, you know, but really thinking more about what comes back every year and, as you said, is regenerative, really, you know, keeps producing more and more. And you know, if our food stopped coming, you know, and I couldn't get seeds, you know, yes, I'd save seeds, but
I
guess I probably have enough seeds saved for a very long time, at least my life, but still I'd run out, you know. So it's just really a great perspective. So tell us a little bit about the film.
I mean, just to clarify for people who might not, there's a difference between plants that are perennial and different plants that are annual. So annual plants grow one year and put out seed and then die. And perennial plants continue to grow year after year and keep producing food, like a hazelnut shrub or a blueberry bush. And I think what you're referring to basically is this idea of how can we make our food system not 100% based on annuals like it is right now in terms of soy, corn, you know, these things that grow one year, broccoli integrate and have like a more balanced of perennial and annual, you know, a little more resiliency, a little bit more like a forest would be, or like a natural ecology.
Mm-hmm. Are there any greens that you know of that come back every year that are not, that are perennials, not annuals?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so there's a great book. So one of the guys in the film is named Eric Tomsmeyer, and he's done a lot of research on perennial vegetables. And I highly recommend if people are interested in thinking about creating low maintenance gardens that they don't, maybe don't have a lot of time, or they want to experiment with things that parts of the property they don't spend a lot of time on. There's definitely some really cool perennial vegetables out there. There's one called sea kale. And sea kale is basically a kale that comes from the coast of England, and it's a perennial kale. You know, they have one that's about 15 years old, I think, in their garden. And it, you know, gives you young shoots in the spring that you can eat, and then nice leaves in the fall. There's also one called Turkish Rocket, which will give you like a little broccoli in the fall and really nice greens in the spring. So, yeah, there's a lot out there in terms of expanding the palette of perennial and annual vegetables.
Yeah, that sounds really exciting to me. That's something I would like to experiment with some more. Because right now I do, you know, and I live for those greens. And, you know, I'm so happy. I mean, sometimes my kale comes back. It's like it will be the first thing peeking through the snow in March. But you can't count on it, you know. It sometimes does and sometimes doesn't.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
so
I think, you know.
Talk to us a little bit about the film.
Yeah, so the film... So after I took the permaculture course, I realized pretty quickly that there wasn't any documentaries that were sufficiently covering or explaining what the permaculture movement was about. And the only films that were out there were really these ones from Australia that were kind of outdated. They were from the 80s. And so I started making a couple short films around the Northeast, just putting together some short pieces about some of the teachers I had met through the network, and kind of quickly realized that there was so much there and that it really deserved, you know, more of a feature-length film. And so I basically set out with my friend Emmett Brennan, and we basically, over the course of 2 years, documented about 30 different sites. And it started with farms because that is what I had basically learned and started learning on, you know, different permaculture-designed farms. But it really quickly moved into urban areas, looking at green roofs, you know, rainwater catchment systems in cities, rainwater overflow design in streets and parks. And then we really also moved into the suburbs. And the suburbs is really important, we realized, because that's where the majority of people in the country, you know, a lot of people live in the suburbs, a lot of people live in the city, and then, you know, you have the rural community. So we were trying to find kind of the balance between all the places that people live, and so we could, you know, really have relevancy to everyone who watched the film. So we really focused on finding the balance. So it wasn't going to, we didn't want to basically exclude anyone. So the idea was that anyone watching the film can relate to somebody in the film. So we covered from Maine to Wisconsin over 3 years altogether, from beginning to end. And we released the film about a year ago. And, and it's been really fun to kind of share this because there hasn't been a film covering the permaculture ideas or the techniques in action yet. And so for a lot of people, it was the first time to see a lot of this stuff beyond just reading about it or learning about it in a class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved the, I guess maybe partly because I live in suburbia, I really related to the suburban sites where they transform their backyard, front yard into, you know, almost like a forest. I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah. Which
one was that?
Example.
You know which one
What's
I'm talking
that?
About?
Sorry, what was that?
I'm saying, which one was that? Do you know the one I'm talking about where it was, you know, a small house and there these cute kids?
Yeah. So I think the one you're referring to is Eric Tomsmeyer and his neighbor Jonathan. They basically worked together on a, about a, I think it's about a quarter, maybe a tenth of an acre. It's a very small plot. And they actually put out a book called Paradise Lot, and it's about turning this gravelly, rocky, barren, small backyard lot into this food forest. And they have a lot of amazing examples at that property, and if you check out the book and in the film, of using how would a forest grow, if a forest was going to grow in the backyard, how would it grow? And so they basically took that concept but tried to grow a forest, a small-scale, you know, forest with all food. So they put in fruit trees and fruit shrubs and fruit annuals, small, like, under the, you know, the vegetation layer down below, and then they put in a bunch of different fruiting vines, basically covering it with vegetation. And then they brought in a small pond and chickens and created this small ecosystem, you know, with the main thing coming out of it being all this fruit and all these vegetables. And, you know, within a couple of years, they started to see monarch butterflies, they started to see songbirds return, they started to see frogs and salamanders. So the main mission there was to show that even on a really small scale, you can really bring back biology into the site while producing this food for people. So there's just, you get these two benefits. You get this food production while getting this ecosystem regeneration. And I think they're one of the coolest sites, too, because it's such a small scale, but it's so lush. And, you know, you have this sense of this little Garden of Eden right in the middle of suburbia.
Right. Yeah, it was astonishing. It's just amazing. So I want to know the difference between permaculture, organic farming, biodynamics, and then, of course, I think most people know conventional agriculture, which is what everybody does.
Right.
Can you share a little bit the difference? Actually, you know what? Let's take a couple-minute break. Think about that, and when we come back, share that with everyone, okay?
Sounds
and we're
going
to take a couple-minute break. Everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Costa Boutis. How do you say your last name? I'm so sorry.
No, it's Boutikaris. Yeah, it's a Greek name.
Boutikaris, okay. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Be right back.
Listening to PRN, number one for progressive minds.
Carrie Harrison with you, inviting you to join me on The Smart Show every Monday from 6 to 7.
In the beginning, 1212, live from the Midtown studios of the Progressive Radio Network. It's Zach and Jesse. Yeah, babe. Millennials running the show. Here we are. Check 1212. You got me? 222. Sound good?
FM. If you like a smart show, then join me, Carrie Harrison. It's Harrison on the Progressive Radio Network. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
The Dr. Peter Breggin Hour interviews the most exciting innovators in the field of mental health, from therapists and researchers to advocates of patient rights. Join me and other pioneers in psychology, psychiatry, and empathic living with the aim of improving your life and the lives of everyone you touch. Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Listen live or on the archives 24/7 at PRN.FM. Don't forget to rate the show on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and Costa Boutsakaris is my guest. He is the award-winning film producer of the film Inhabit, and we're just talking about that. It's a great film on permaculture. So before the break, Costa, I was asking you the difference between permaculture, organic farming, biodynamic farming, compared to conventional, traditional agriculture. Can you share a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, and that's a great question because it comes up a lot. And I think the most important thing to realize is that permaculture is really a design process. And it's a design process that is basically a lens that you can look at any system and think about how can this system work more efficiently? How can it be more self-maintaining? How can it basically, how can this system act more like an ecosystem? And so you can take that design thinking and apply it to agriculture or city design or suburban development or even social systems. So that's what I think is really important about permaculture, is it isn't one focused thing. There is no like single technique that makes something permaculture, but it's more of a design process that makes you think, you know, how can I design really functional interrelationships between pieces and, you know, create more of a holistic system. So that, I think for us, making the documentary, it was like, wow, this is really cool because we could actually go to a rooftop garden in New York City and learn about permaculture principles they're using, and then go to a 100-acre field in the Midwest and learn about permaculture principles they're using there. And there's actually a lot of similarities between, you know, ways you can regenerate and redesign a farm in the Midwest, a rooftop in New York City, and a backyard, you know, in suburbia. So it's kind of this design process and this toolkit of thinking about relationship design, basically.
Uh-huh. Can you share with us an example of, like, how one might take a traditional plant bed where you're growing something and make it more of a permaculture design? Like, what makes something more of a permaculture design?
Right. So so permaculture has these 12 principles, these 12 design principles, and all the principles are basically based on kind of the core foundations of how ecosystems work. So that basically the permaculture design process came from, it was basically put together by these guys in Australia who were thinking about, you know, we have these ecosystems that function on their own with no humans maintaining them, fertilizing them, pruning them, you know, cutting them back, trimming them. You know, we have these incredible forests, these incredible, you know, all these different types of ecosystems that work on their own. And we can't seem to do that in our world of agriculture. In our world of agriculture, is highly demanding inputs from around the world, highly demanding all this energy, highly demanding, you know, just all these different inputs that, you know, as we're seeing today, as you're covering on your show, it looks like, it, you know, are really, you know, as people know more and more, there's just so many negatives coming out of that and so many destructive pieces. So it's really thinking about, well, how can we take the principles of an ecosystem and apply it to whatever system we're using? So when you're talking about something like a garden, which is basically where permaculture starts, because the garden gives you this incredible feedback of how you're doing, you know, and it gives you this incredible sense of, you know, is there life? Is it healthy? Is the food healthy? Is there biology here? You know, are there birds singing? Are there bugs and insects? And it gives you this really beautiful living feedback system. And so, yeah, so some of the basics, I guess, in a permaculture gardening thinking would be, you know, one thing would be that you really never want your soil exposed. Because if you go into the forest or if you go into the meadow or the wetlands, you really never see exposed dirt. Because exposed dirt is basically like a wound in the ground, right? You always see some kind of ground cover or plant that's going to cover the soil. You always see something that nature's going to use to cover the soil. So, you know, one of the main principles with permaculture, maybe gardening, would be you really want to keep the soil covered with a mulch layer. If you don't have, like, straw or different kinds of mulch layers, you want to think about a ground planting cover, like clover or something that's going to cover the soil. So it's really about just thinking, you know, what goes on in an ecosystem that we can bring here, and that will actually save us work and energy around. Because weeding is really this process of, you know, the weeds grow because the soil is exposed and the ground, you know, the natural system wants to cover the soil up. So we're just trying to fill in those gaps and make sure we don't have to be putting in as much input. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense, somebody?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. So I'm thinking about my garden. So, you know, in between in between the rows, you know, I put down leaves and stuff, so that's what I'm walking on. But where the plants are actually growing, in a permaculture, more permaculture-designed garden, you would put leaves around the soil, around the plants as well, or straw, or...
Yeah, you definitely want to think about creating ways to cover the soil, because if you don't, you know, weeds are going to grow, and weeds are really just protecting the soil. You know, another great principle is, like, thinking about, you know, plants that help each other out. And so there's a great example in the film where we look at, you know, kale. A lot of people love to grow kale, and there's, you know, lots of bugs that love to come and eat holes in the kale. But when you grow dill next to kale, dill attracts in, you know, parasitic wasps and different other parasitic bugs that will actually eat the bugs that eat the kale. So you get these really cool interrelationships when you start creating more diversified planting. So something I would definitely recommend people checking out and thinking about permaculture gardening would be plant guilds or plant allies, you know, plants that work well together because they might attract in the bugs.
Companion planting is what I call it,
Yeah, companion planting is another word for it. Yeah, so just thinking about, you know, how can I diversify my garden, keep it mulched, and maybe it will be more self-maintaining. Maybe I have to do a little bit less work, and the garden will actually be better.
Yeah, that's great to know. Yeah, I do that with basil and tomatoes. You know, that's, they go very well together, and they help keep the bugs off the tomato plants.
Oh, yeah. And then some other things just quickly would be like, you know, the inputs you're putting into your garden. So if you're using water to water your garden, yeah, I mean, maybe if you're in a climate you don't need to water, but a lot of us do. So, you know, thinking about where's that water coming from? You know, is it coming from, you know, the city source water, or is there rainwater that you can catch off of the local, you know, the roof right next to you that you can use so you don't have to create an energy input, so it can just be water that's stored from the rain? You know, or thinking about compost, is there compost that you can be recycling that you're using in your kitchen that can be going back into the garden? So starting to think about closing those loops of water and nutrients, and, you know, just trying to make it a little bit more self-maintaining.
Actually, that was something that I found fascinating when I went to your website before the interview, and I'm, you know, reading all about other parts of what you did. You actually converted a van from diesel to accept vegetable oil. How did that work?
Yeah, so that's actually a whole really interesting piece. And there's a lot of great films out there about that. So we didn't want to focus on that on our film. And I recommend a film called Fuel, which really looks at diesel.
I'm sorry, what is it? What's the film?
The film's called Fuel.
Fuel, okay.
And that's a documentary specifically about vegetable oil running in a diesel engine. And he travels around the world learning all about the history of it. And it turns out that the diesel engine was actually designed to run on peanut oil. And it was designed by Rudolf Diesel in Germany so peanut farmers could actually supply themselves with their own fuel for their engines. So it's actually designed to be a vegetable oil engine. A lot of people don't realize that. And there's a lot of mysterious stuff about his death. No one's really sure what happened, but there's a lot of theories that it might have been, you know, he disappeared off of a boat when he was coming across the ocean to install 1,000 more diesel of these vegetable oil engines and tractors and stuff. So there's a lot of mystery about what happened to him. But basically, he created this vegetable oil engine, and it really lost traction and became, like, it really... just the whole concept around it, you know, switched over into this diesel engine because they were able to create a similar fuel to run it out of just regular oil from the ground, just regular. It's a different extraction process they use, but they could turn oil into diesel oil. So basically, it's been modified to be to run on diesel fuel, but it originally actually was a vegetable engine. So you don't have to modify the engine really at all. All you have to do is create a system to heat up the vegetable oil so it's at a really hot temperature, so the viscosity, so it's very watery and it's not jelly. So all you're really doing is creating a tank, a separate tank, that can heat up the vegetable oil. And you can do that by running it through some coils with some heaters. Really, really simple. And you only have to heat the oil to about 85 degrees or higher, and it's pretty amazing how simple it is, and it really works. It's difficult to find really good quality vegetable oil because you need to do a lot of filtering, so that's the only challenge, because filtering, you really want to have a garage to filter it all in. You really can't do it on the road. So we ended up buying filtered vegetable oil from cooperatives around the Northeast that sell it. But other than that, it's a really cool
process.
But
you're talking about used vegetable oil, right? Like the vegetable oil that comes out of, you know, Burger King's deep fryer, right?
So there's cooperatives around the Northeast that take used waste vegetable oil, and they filter it at a central location, and then they sell, and then you can buy it for like a dollar a gallon or something like that. And you're basically still getting this used vegetable oil that's just really, really well filtered, getting all the gunk and water out of it. And so you're still running on a waste product, but it's part of a cooperative. So you're all, so you don't have to do all the basically the processing. So it's a really cool way to be part of that network. And it kind of, everyone can kind of support each other that way, which is really cool. There's also farms, you know, there's a lot of farms starting to transition to running on sunflower seed oil and different kinds of grain seed oil. So there's some really cool potential for that down the road.
Oh, I had these great visions of you, you know, pulling up to Burger King and putting a funnel into your gas tank, you know, with a strainer on top of it, and pouring the water right through the strainer into the funnel into your gas tank.
Yeah, we did too. Unfortunately, the only challenge is that the vegetable oil waste that you get from Burger King and anywhere else is going to have a lot of water in it. And if you get water into your engine, it's pretty much the end of your engine. So the easiest way to get the water out is you let it sit for about a week, and then you can just drain the water right off the top. But if you don't have a way to like let it sit for a week, you have to have some pretty fancy equipment to do a really fancy dewatering filter. So the best solution is really to have a central base if you're going to be a vegetable oil car. And if you have a home base where you can filter, it's extremely easy, and a lot of people do it every day. There's a lot of people running their old Mercedes and their cars on vegetable oil. But if you want to do a cross-country trip without investing too much into it, you can still do it by buying from these cooperatives who filter the oil, and then you can just pay the oil bit for it. So there's still a lot of great options.
I assume there's
really
a website you can find online.
Who's interested. Buy it online.
I'm saying you can find the website online about these cooperatives?
Yeah, you can find them online for sure. Yeah, there's a lot of great resources out there for filtered veggie oil. But it's really cool, you know, in a permaculture principle, it's like there's no such thing as waste, right? So it's like in an ecosystem, there's no such thing as garbage. It's just food for something else. So that's really cool when thinking about vegetable oil waste. You know, it's really, you can really use it as a fuel. And, you know, it's coming from a plant. So that's a pretty amazing thing.
Right. Yeah, and can you use, this is for a diesel engine. Can you use a regular gasoline engine? Can that be converted to take vegetable oil?
No, a gasoline engine could never run on vegetable oil, unfortunately.
Okay.
Interestingly, though, there is a way to convert a gasoline engine to run on methane. And there is some really interesting work by this guy, Jean Payne, the French guy, who was able to capture methane coming out of compost piles with really simple homemade technology. And he converted his trucks to run on methane. And he actually converted his house, his cooking, all his stoves and ovens and stuff to run on methane as well, that he was capturing out of the compost pile. And he's actually, a lot of permaculture people really love him because he was able to take something that we never think about, methane leaving a compost pile, and he was actually turning it into a resource. So there's a lot of cool options when it comes to, like, the future of transportation, but there's not enough funding behind this stuff, you know. There's so much money in the oil industry that it's hard to imagine that there would ever be a really good consumer model of any of this stuff, unfortunately.
Right, and if you get two out there, you got to watch out, just like the guy who disappeared. You know, you just never know. I mean, you hear so many stories about that, those kind of things, you know, when somebody, starts peeling back the truth.
Or
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Yeah, I mean, so many things where you see, like, their lab will burn down and all their stuff is gone, and, you know, all these, like, water engines and all these different, people trying to push the limit of what's possible.
Yeah, scientists who speak against GMOs, you know, who get, you know, ousted from their job and their reputation stripped. And, you know, it's just so corrupt. We know about that. Talking about funding, though, how did you pay for your film?
Yeah, so we didn't have any money when we started the film. And, you know, most films, so we were right out of college, and most documentaries are based off grants. So you get maybe like a $25,000 grant through one foundation, and then you kind of have to keep this tight relationship with them, and it becomes a very close relationship that, you know, some people have problems with because they want something and the foundation might not want something, and, you know, you can run into a lot of issues with that. So we decided to do crowdfunding, and crowdfunding is basically, so Kickstarter was the platform we used. Crowdfunding is basically where instead of having one place donate a whole chunk of money, you ask the internet, anyone who's on the internet, on social media, anyone out there who wants to donate maybe $5, $10, $25 in exchange for getting a DVD or a download. And, you know, 800 people later, we were able to raise about $40,000. And through that, we created a huge network of people that were following the project, that were invested in the project, and that were really a part of the project. And we would send out surveys to our Kickstarter fans. We sent, some of the people who donated a little bit on the higher end, we invited them to, like, an online screening and feedback and for the first draft of the film. And so we really created this community that was actually, you know, they actually funded the film, and they were our support network. And so it's a really beautiful way to fund projects, especially, you know, we kind of tried to tie in this permaculture thinking. We're like, we don't want to get all our energy from one place. You know, that's kind of, in terms of thinking about resiliency, you want to have a lot, you want to get a little bit of energy from a lot of places, you know, just like a tree would. You don't want to just get it all from one place, because if that one thing fails, the whole system fails. So the idea of having 800 people being our kind of like our root network, it's kind of a really cool way to fund these kind of projects, and it gives you a lot more freedom, and it gives you just a really fun community to work with.
Right. Well, it sounds like we're out of time. I'm sorry. This always happens. You run out of time. But anyway, thank you, Costa, and everybody out there listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll see you all again next Thursday. Bye. Have a great rest of the week.